David Cleaves is the former climate change advisor with the U.S. Forest Service, and he's on his own now consulting on issues related to forests and climate change. He's an MSU alumnus, so David, it's great to have you home and welcome to the program.
Oh, it's fantastic to be here. It's been many years and many decades, actually, but I'm so excited with what I'm seeing is going on here at Michigan State in relation to sustainability that it's just great to be back on campus.
Dave, you're here tonight to deliver a talk titled Forests, People, and Climate Change, A New No-Normal World. Sort of tell us what that no-normal world is now.
Well, there are so many changes being driven by the changing climate itself. You know, it's not just about climate change by itself. It's changing climate as it connects to all kinds of other changes. So it's and as what we're seeing here is evidence of so many changes in temperature and precipitation and forest fires and that relate to those changes that there's really no average anymore. The future is, as we look forward, is a future really of the new normal being no normal, and that the students now that are becoming professionals are going to be dealing with a career in of 30, 40, 50 years in which the past, it will be helpful, but not the only guidepost. And they're going to have to keep adjusting and adapting as the normal constantly changes to the point where there's no normal to actually work with. And they need to develop the expectations and the skills and the adaptive capacity to deal with that.
Because we really are experiencing unprecedented environmental change in our forests and everywhere, aren't we?
Yeah, until relatively recently, this was the domain of projections and forecasts in the future. But the evidence is mounting that we certainly have a changing climate, and that changing climate is changing more rapidly than it ever has. So trying to keep up with it, trying to get ahead of it, trying to understand those changes is a real whole set of challenges.
And David, you said the relationships between forests and people are being profoundly affected by the changing climate. Tell me more about how so.
Well, the climate is just one part of the relationship that surrounds in the context of the relationships between forests and people. Actually, the forests are in relatively good shape. We haven't had this many forests and forests that are in this good of health in decades. Forests are everywhere, and people are everywhere. The population has grown, so we can't really avoid one another. The forest and people have this kind of ongoing relationship, whether it be urban or rural or in somewhere in between. And but as the forest changes in response to the changing climate, the options that are available for people to use and enjoy the forest gets changed. Sometimes those options get reduced. Sometimes the emergencies surrounding our management of the forest become more important, higher on the agenda. For example, the wildfire situation has just exploded in the West primarily, and so we've had to put resources into handling that problem and take resources away from handling other issues and other opportunities. So all of these shifts that occur in response to the changing climate are shifts in these relationships between people and forest and how it plays out in policy and public issues. And so it's an exciting time, actually, to be a new professional, not even necessarily a forestry professional, but professionals in urban planning and other domains to be wrestling with these issues and bringing the skills and the enthusiasm of a new generation to bear on it.
And David Cleaves, you know, you've indicated here foresters are on the front line of dealing with climate change in many ways, or the changing climate. What issues are our current and future foresters facing?
Well, one is dealing with a set of risks that are manifesting themselves in the extreme. What we see are changing distributions of precipitation, temperature that are shifting so that we're seeing more and more big fires, big rainstorms, big windstorms. And so it's these extreme events that in any situation cause the greatest damage. We may have 100,000 fires across the country in a year, but only a small portion, maybe less than 5% of those, account for maybe 70 to 80% of the loss that's associated with those fires. And as the climate changes, that distribution of those events shifts to give us a higher proportion of those as really big events. So how do you deal with that? How do you deal with what we call peak loads? If the road system was all designed with assumptions about what the peak load event was going to be, like rainstorms, 1-in-100-year rainstorms, now that 1-in-100-year rainstorm is going to be a 1-in-30-year rainstorm, you're going to have more of that kind of extreme impact on a road system and a forest that you're going to have to readjust to. Perhaps not overnight, but you're going to have to redesign. And when you replace the road system and the culverts, the pipes that run under the roads that take the water under the roads, you're going to have to reconsider, and you're going to have to use new standards. So that's just one example of the kind of practical on-the-ground kind of decisions that foresters are going to have to wrestle with. Another one is if some of our forest systems are actually migrating slowly, but they're migrating in response to a changing climate, we have a fire and we're going to regenerate or replant. What do we replant with? Do we replant with the tree species and the genetic material we used before, or do we make a bet, so to speak, a scientific calculated bet, and plant a species that's perhaps more drought tolerant, more associated with a southern environment that's basically headed our way anyway? So there's some real key long-term decisions that foresters have to wrestle with, because the consequences of the forester's decision on behalf of the public, the stakeholders, play out over 40, 50, 60, or 70 years. So these are tough decisions, and to be robust in your decision making to kind of cover as many bets as you can is kind of hard work.
And David, you're a recognized leader in integrating the sciences of sustainability into organizational cultures and decision processes. How do you integrate climate change consciousness into everyday thinking in organizations?
Well, it's an important issue, and I think that many companies and many agencies, organizations in general, will sooner or later have to wrestle with the issues of climate change, whether it be adapting to climate change or how do we actually help solve it through mitigation. So in those two areas requires some capacity building. It requires that people start to be trained, not to become everyone become a climate change specialist, not for everybody to become a sustainability expert, but to be able to take what you're doing now and weave into it those implications that make a difference in terms of a changing climate, and then change, if it's appropriate, the way you're going about doing things. So in the Forest Service, where I just came from, our job was to integrate climate change throughout the programs of the entire organization. This is 35,000 people and 150 national forests and grasslands and a research organization. So we built a system, we called it a climate scorecard or climate action scorecard, in which we built just enough structure that the people who ran the different parts of the organization could wrestle on their own terms with how do we bring that science into the way we do business. We talked about the road situation. We also talked, one big challenge was that the forest that the Forest Service and many other forestry agencies and organizations manage is a tremendous resource for carbon sequestration. Of all the emissions that all the sectors in the country, economy-wide, create, 15% of that is buffered, that is offset by the sequestration that occurs not only in the forest, but also, importantly, in the extended storage that occurs in wood products as the forest are harvested for any number of objectives. So forestry is in a unique situation here of not only being able to sequester forests through growing trees, but also to capture and store that carbon for a long, long time. I mean, as we sit in a room and look at the wood in that room, that's carbon that was stored for a long time, 100 plus years of trees that were harvested a long time ago. And so if we can use the power of sequestration and storage to help offset even to a greater degree what we're offsetting now, 15% is a huge service that basically is really, really not paid for by, we don't have a carbon tax, we don't have a nationwide cap and trade system that would send dollars and resources to encourage even greater sequestration. And we know that we can do even a better job of carbon sequestration and storage by increasing the forest practices, regeneration, sustainable wood products, fire and fuels management in the right places, forest health improvement for insect and disease. All of that really gives us back some of that sequestration and storage that we might have lost otherwise. So I think there's a great opportunity there, and we've started in the Forest Service providing a carbon footprint for every national forest over the last 20 years so that they can go in and now begin to make their own decisions about how they're going to weave that into all the other objectives they have.
David, what about public policy implications for all we've talked about? Where are we there?
Well, I think we'll see climate change is an interesting issue, let's put it that way. And coming from Washington, D.C., not originally, but I've been there the last 18 years, it's kind of a cauldron of policy and political debate. And if you say the word climate change in just anywhere in the country, actually you get kind of different reactions, some of them largely ideologically based even. It's almost a label that goes out there. But I think many of the public policy discussions going forward are really going to be how do we meet the commitments that we have already made in the Paris Agreement and will continue to be leavened in the future because the U.S. is about 18% of the global emissions, and people look to the U.S. for leadership. But how do you implement those commitments back in the country? What policy mechanisms do you use? Will we ever have a carbon tax? If we do, where will the dollars for the carbon tax go, which may be actually even a more important question in the future? If some of those dollars from any kind of a carbon tax or cap and trade system could go back to natural resources, for example, to forestry, to manage that forest resource we talked about, that would be a good result. And it's a win-win situation, because when we manage the forest sustainably, we not only get carbon back, but we get wildlife habitat, we get wood products, we get watershed protection. It's a really kind of a package deal there. So those debates and arguments, I would imagine, will start back up again as we get through this administration transition and at the federal level. But actually, many of the really creative policy approaches that are going that have been made have been at the state level. There have been some fantastic thinking and development at the state level, and California has a cap and trade program. It's now connected to Quebec, and, of course, the regional greenhouse gas initiative. I think there are 20 states, I believe, I may have that wrong, that in the Northeast who have developed a multi-state agreement, and in the early days for cap and trade, like before we had the recession, they were actually more active than they are now. But we see them responding now to the Obama Clean Power Plan, which offers the opportunity for multiple states to get together and manage toward the goals that are set in the power plan. That is up for, that's under litigation and legal discussion right now. But I think that some of these key questions that we might have seen before will be brought up again in the policy discussion, frankly, because the changing climate has gotten worse, or has gotten more intense. And I think more people have come to recognize and have realized that, yes, we do have a changing climate. I think more people also think and believe that at least part of that, if not a large part of that, is due to anthropogenic emissions. And maybe there's something we can do about that. And so I think there are some positive developments in the policy discussions. We'll see. We'll see what this administration change brings us. But I think there's still lots and lots of things we can do on the ground.
Dave, as we close, just summarize then for our listeners what you'd like them to take away about our conversation and the messages you'll hope to leave at your talk at MSU.
I think the single message that I want to bring across is that there are things that we can do to respond to a changing climate. There's lots of science. There's great new science. If we can get that science into solutions and put it on the ground, and what a great place to do that other than a land-grant university like Michigan State and in partnership with the other universities and other organizations. So I think partnerships and science and priorities will give us some solutions that give us hope about a changing climate. I do not like to hear discussions about climate being all gloom and doom. I think that there may even be opportunities in a changing climate. Uncertainty is not necessarily good or bad until you frame it as good or bad. And as we move forward, we're going to have to use our creativity.
David, thank you so much for sharing your insights with us today.
Okay, thank you very much.
David Cleaves is the former climate change advisor with the U.S. Forest Service, and he's now out on his own consulting on these important issues of climate change and our forests. And I'm Russ White for Greening of the Great Lakes.